WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Nelson George has a new collection of essays about the culture of African Americans who came of age after the Civil Rights Movement. The book is called Bubbies, B-Boys, Baps, and Bohos, Notes on Post-Soul Black Culture. If you need a translation, Buppies are black urban professionals, B-Boys are the males of hip-hop culture, Baps are black American princes or princesses, and Bohos are bohemians. George has also co-written and co-produced a new movie that satirizes hip-hop culture called CB4, starring Chris Rock of Saturday Night Live. It opens next month. Nelson George is a Village Voice columnist, the former black music editor of Billboard, and the author of several books, including A History of Motown, A Postmortem on the Death of Rhythm and Blues, and A Study of Blacks in Basketball. I asked him if he thinks of himself as a buppy, b-boy, bap, or boho.
Well, I would say as a kid, I'd probably come out of a b-boy environment with definitely buppy aspirations. And maybe a bit of boho experience now that I've worked in the Village and at the Village Voice for a number of years, and which affected a lot of my more b-boy thinking.
Flesh that out for us. Tell us a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in and what your aspirations were.
Well, I grew up in what initially was just sort of a working class project back when projects were new and bright and shiny. It was called the Tilden Projects. Samuel J. Tilden, one of our former governors way back in the 1800s, I think. But as time went on, it was basically went from being black and white and Hispanic to being black and Hispanic. And it also became increasingly drug infested. And I remember very well in, was it 68, I think. I really remember heroin coming in.
How did that affect your day-to-day life?
Well, at first it didn't seem that bad, but over time, it became very, very dangerous just to get in and out of the building. Guys, the whole idea of breaking into mailboxes and stealing people's checks as they came in became very big. The junkies would break the elevators, basically, and try and knock out the lights on the stairway so that people had to go up the staircase up to get to their apartments, and they would try and rob them. So in about the late 70s, early 70s, my mother moved me and my sister out of the Tilden Projects to East New York, which at that time also was still basically a more integrated working class area. So that we kept chasing the white middle class across Brooklyn. They kept leaving when we got there. Because I moved into another housing development, which actually is about across the street from where Starrett City is in Brooklyn, which is a huge kind of housing complex that was built out of landfill.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was something that started out as very, very integrated and became basically more and more black over time.
You said your aspirations kind of fit the buppy category. What were your aspirations when you were young?
Well, I wanted to be one of those guys. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to be Sidney Poitier. I mean, like any good black kid did then. You wanted to have a job where you had a suit and a white shirt and had dignity and all that great stuff that Sidney Poitier had in all those movies, you know. And that's what I kind of thought I saw myself sort of becoming. And at the same time, the blaxploitation movies came in. And there was this whole other idea of cool and style that they brought in that affected me, too. So, you know, you both wanted to be successful and fit into the mainstream. But at the same time, you also wanted to have kind of an edge to you. And, they're kind of contradictory in a way, those kind of desires. But those are the things that kind of drove me as a younger guy.
Did you have two different kinds of personalities to match with each aspiration?
No, I think the cool thing was a fantasy thing. I think basically I was a bookworm.
Did people make fun of you for being a bookworm?
Oh, back then, absolutely. I mean, I definitely was the kid who wrote poetry to the cute girl in school and got laughed at in the school. I mean, I actually did this. I don't use her name. I even remember her name. This girl had a huge H-bomb afro in junior high school, and I wrote her a poem in the style of Michelle by the Beatles. I sort of wrote her a love poem, and I gave it to her one day in the cafeteria, and boy, it was a disaster. It was a disaster. People were screaming, laughing. It got passed around the entire school. So, I mean, the days of sensitivity, you realize sensitivity wasn't always the move.
And what about the boho part of you?
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the great journeys out of that part of Brooklyn for me and my friends in high school was to go to the Village. That was like an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I was always fascinated with the fact that there was another world outside of the Brooklyn that I knew. The idea that there was all these different ways to be that weren't straight up R&B. And when I say R&B, I mean that R&B always sort of represents to me traditional black view of life. And they were like alternative views. And to this day, I'm very excited and attracted by that idea. Like when I see someone like a Tracy Chapman or a Vernon Reed, the idea that they are challenging the status quo of what African-American culture is in some way, I think is very interesting.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Nelson George. He has a new collection of essays called Buppies, B-Boys, Baps, and Bohos, Notes on Post-Soul Black Culture. He also co-wrote and co-produced the forthcoming movie CB4, which is a parody of the hip-hop scene. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Nelson George is my guest. Do you still feel that in some ways you're in between different parts of the black community? For instance, you write a lot about hip-hop, but now you yourself are moving into the film industry, which is a much more kind of affluent and in some ways status quo part of show business?
Oh, my God, there's such a difference between the record business and the film business. I used to always think that they're both in the media business. They're both, they shouldn't, you know, they should be working closer together, but they are two different cultures totally. Record people, music people are so much closer to the street. They go to clubs. They stay out late. They are very sensitive to every shift in taste in subcultures, be it black subculture, white youth subculture, Athens, Georgia to Philadelphia. They're very interested in local scenes, and they always see the potential of something small becoming national because that's the history of music. The film business is totally top down. They would rather, in general, make the most bland, boring thing they could possibly make, or the most bland, predictable thing they can make. They're very scared of anything that's too specialized. They're very scared of anything that's too cutting edge because they're afraid of alienating people. So the mentalities are very different. I mean, I think that film people are probably better educated in terms of having college pedigrees, but they're probably much less educated in terms of understanding America.
Well, you know, you write that when you were active in the Stop the Violence movement, within rap, that you felt that you were kind of having to bridge the gap between the civil rights groups and people from hip-hop who really didn't quite comprehend each other. What were the differences between them?
It totally goes into this idea of what I call soul and post-soul culture. I mean, there are people who came up totally in an era of the gospel church, of civil rights, of we shall overcome, of a great sense of optimism and moving into the mainstream, which is what a group like, say, the Urban League represents. And then there's another group of kids who've come up who really don't believe in the gospel, the Christian church very much, have a great deal of cynicism toward elected officials. I mean, the black elected officials that most of the kids that were rappers grew up under are the peers of the people who run these organizations. So the perception of who these people are and what their contribution is very different. I think most young people in general are cynical about politics. And a kid in the black community who may have grown up under a black congressman and a black mayor and seen black people in prominent positions has a totally different perception of power. He thinks that most mainstream politicians are no different than a lot of the white politicians that he or she may come in contact with. So there's this great gap of believability.
Being someone who's written about music all your life, how do you feel now writing about hip-hop and knowing most of the people making hip-hop records are a lot younger than you are? They just share a different cultural reference points than you do, which makes you kind of the outsider in the older generation, which, of course, is something that happens gradually.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm still excited about records. I'm still excited about getting a new Naughty by Nature album. Mm-hmm. But I am less curious overall. I often now, instead of me trying to, I will let the street tell me what's of interest. Because I've always trusted young black kids, particularly the ones who are active record buyers, they are cultural leaders in terms of their taste. I can't dictate to any of them what they should or shouldn't buy. What I can do is sort of put everything in a context and also try and there's certain musical values that are absolute, though. about a good song or a bad song. The first time I ever heard OPP, the first time I heard it, I said, this is one of the best records I ever heard. It's just incredible. It just had that vitality and that smartness and that energy that means that's just a great record. But then there's some records that are more ambiguous for me that I'm not sure about. They're like, I mean, for years and years, I never could get EPMD, the rap group, only because I couldn't understand what they were saying. And when I knew I couldn't understand what they were saying, I knew that I am getting old, that I don't understand everything that's going on in the culture. So I think you have to be really very, very intelligent about your limitations.
Let me get back to OPP, and this gets to a problem that I think a lot of people, including myself, have with some rap music, that no matter how innovative some of the beats are, you're dealing with, in some instances, lyrics that are really hopelessly sexist, like in OPP, where the P stands for the slang word that starts with P for women's genitals.
It also stands for the non-slang word for male genitals.
Oh, okay. We see this, and this is me, the outsider, who doesn't quite get all the rap slang, but still, you know, it's pretty sexist stuff. A lot of it.
Well, I mean, my whole attitude on rap has been that rap is a reflection of the community that creates it. Now, to attack, I mean, and there's been many attacks on many rappers and many rap artists in particular songs, but the bottom line is the songs are a product of a collective sense. And if you're going to deal with it, you really have to deal with the sense itself, what creates these attitudes. It's never been a chicken or the egg thing with me and rap, that these records create or even condone activity. They report the ideas of the street, or it's a shared common knowledge. It might not be common knowledge we want to be shared. It might be stuff that we detest. But it reflects a true reality. It's one of the few mediums that exist in this country where young men and women from a poor background who may be black can say uncensored and almost unencumbered what they think about a lot of different issues, what interests them, what impacts on them. And sexism of various kinds is a big part of the mentality of a very adolescent culture. Mm-hmm. And we may object to it, and I think we should object to it, but that's the bottom line. The only way to really stop it is either to not to buy the records or to really mount a campaign of some kind at the basic mentality that creates the records. I mean, again, OPP to me was a witty record because I listened to the whole lyric, and OPP deals both with men getting with women and women getting with men of the other partner. To me, that record was more democratic in a sense than most. I mean, there's a lot of rap records that really you could have an issue with. OPP I was a mild, very mild example.
The movie that you co-wrote, CB4, is opening March 12th. I've just seen Coming Attractions, but it looks like it's a parody of the hip-hop scene. Can you give us a preview of what the movie's about?
Well, the film deals, you know, very, very explicitly with the issues you've raised, actually. It's about a middle-class black kid played by Chris Rock from Saturday Night Live who decides the way to get paid, the way to have mad fame, is to become a gangster rapper. And we picked a gangster rapper because there's no more controversial, more objectionable form of American culture right now. I mean, it's gangster rap is a music that black adults don't like. It's a music that many women of all shades and varieties don't like. It's a music that's been attacked both by corporate America and by right-wing politicians, and often quite successfully. So it's a target of so much hostility, it seems ripe for parody. A, because the music itself and the creations are so over the top. And the response to it, you know, from the right wing, from black adults, from women, from even rival rappers, is so intense that it almost gives us a chance to really do a parody about American culture.
One last question. You grew up listening to a lot of soul music. You wrote a book on the history of Motown Records. Your tastes have expanded as music has changed, and you listen to a lot of hip hop now. I'm sure you haven't given up your appreciation of soul music. Does it bother you, though, that there are probably a lot of young people who see soul music the way a lot of people of my generation probably saw Glenn Miller? Do you know, as just being old-fashioned?
Well, you know what's good, though? The last 2 years, last 2.5 years, I think we've seen a renaissance in R&B by younger artists, by Jodeci, by Mary J. Blige, by Boyz II Men, mm-hmm. And a few others. And I think that some of the traditions of R&B are coming back, but by younger people. What rap did was take a very plasticized form of R&B, which had come up in the 70s and 80s, that cold crossover idea that Lionel Richie sort of epitomized, and had brought it back to the root in the street. And now you have kids who are hip-hop generation kids who want raw R&B, who want guts, because they like guts in hip-hop. And then you have, and that's what Jodeci's about, that's what Mary J. Blige is about. The grooves are very smooth in R&B, but they have a hip-hop flavor, and the singing is very aggressive and tough. And I think that we're seeing a real renaissance in harmony groups. There's a ton of black harmony groups right now in R&B that are young. So I think the future of that form of black music is very bright right now. And I think that into the 80s, I think we're going to see continued hip-hop flavor and continued rap presence, but with more and more growth of good singing and rhythm and blues type music, but not done the old way. I mean, it's the old form, the old artists are no longer important. I mean, the Gladys Knights and the Patti LaBelles are great singers, but it's the younger people bringing this music to their generation who are making the mark.
The Nelson George forecast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nelson George, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nelson George is the author of a new collection of essays called Buppies, B-Boys, Baps, and Bohos. This is Fresh Air.